Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, September 23rd. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News, and I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher Wynn.
Christopher,
by the way, as you know, is the deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News.
Hello, Christopher.
Hello, Christopher. How are you? And hello. Also, as always, joining us is Lauren Smart.
Yes, yeah. Smart.
Lauren is the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hey, Lauren.
Hello.
On today's show, we'll talk with award-winning poet and best-selling memoirist Mary Carr. She's written a new book called The Art of Memoir. Next, Dallas's Sarah Hamilton joins us to discuss directing Upstart Productions' new play, Dryland, about female friendships and abortion. Finally, I talked to actor Matt Damon about his new movie, The Martian, which I also saw. We also talked about his life outside the Hollywood bubble. Lauren and Christopher will join in and cast aspersion and judgment on Mr. Damon as I defend him in our conversation.
So, we're already ready to do that.
Yeah, they're got the knives sharpened. Let's get this started.
God gave me wisdom, but the devil's got style. I'm a mess. Nothing less.
That was the 2012 song I'm a Mess, co-written by Mary Carr and singer Rodney Crowell. Mary Carr writes everything. She writes songs, she writes poems, she writes memoirs, three very good ones. You probably know Carr best as the author of the 1995 memoir The Liars Club, about her dysfunctional childhood in a blue-collar refinery town in southeast Texas. The book earned raves from both critics and readers and helped launch a boom in memoir. Carr wrote two more memoirs, Cherry, about her drug-addled coming of age, and Lit, chronicling her struggle to get sober and find religion. Now she has a new book called The Art of Memoir. Mary Carr, welcome to the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
So Mary, what are you trying to say to the potential memoirists out there? Are you saying don't do it? Or are you saying please do it? What's going on?
No, here? I mostly say don't do it if you can avoid it, because it's going to be really, it's like knocking yourself out with your own fist. I mean, I think it's very hard, but I'm also saying that if you're going to do it, you know, stick to what you know and who you are, and be honest with your reader as much as you can be, you know?
You know, Mary, when The Liars Club came out in the mid-90s, you kind of famously, in some ways, your book kicked off a huge moment in memoirs, especially confessional memoirs. I'm thinking of like...
Any memoir is confessional, right? So,
well,
I mean, what...
True, but there was a moment in publishing history where it was sort of the more lurid the details and the more you kind of drug out there, the more sensational it was. And what a lot of those memoirs didn't have, it seemed like, was your craft, the craft that you brought to your book. I just wonder what you make of that moment, looking back at it now, and where you think we are today with memoirs.
Well, I think memoir as a genre has entered its heyday, and insofar as its readership is concerned. So, I don't think it is the most lurid memoirs that do the best. I disagree. I mean, plenty of people had a worse life than mine, or a worse life than Frank McCourt or Liz Gilbert. You know, we're all people, or Cheryl Strayed. I mean, we're all people who've had our fair share of trouble, but, you know, if lurid was what you wanted, then every Holocaust survivor or sexual assault survivor would be a zillion copy bestseller. So I really think it's how they're written is going to determine whether they last. You know, I think, yeah, there are always a few what they call in the UK misery memoirs. You know, I got up, I took a butt whipping, I got up again, I took another butt whipping, I had another day and there was that other butt whipping. So, right. But most of us know that life really isn't even like that. Even if you're in a horrible situation, it's Yom Kippur, or if you're in a concentration camp, you know, there are things Viktor Frankl taught us in Man's Search for Meaning that, you know, the human spirit longs for, that yearns for. And hopes for.
I'm curious, Mary, if your conversion to Catholicism changed your idea or your concept of truth or the pursuit of some kind of greater truth.
That's a great question. I wish I could say that it had. I've always sort of, or I discovered very, not very quickly, I discovered very slowly over a 10-year period that I'd never be a memoirist, or I'm sorry, I'd never be a novelist, that I just didn't have much talent for fiction. And that, you know, the 4 years I spent writing a novel out of the Liars Club, it was, for me, fiction was an excuse to correct the record and make myself look better than I, in fact, had been. You know, I was a biter. You know, I shot at my neighbor with a BB gun. I mean, I was not a model child. I was a scrappy little critter. So in my novel, I was beautiful and noble and wise as a child.
Yeah.
You know, all things that I didn't happen to be in real life. So, again, a real novelist will tell a greater truth in fiction. But for me, for my nature, for my psychological nature, and maybe because I grew up in a hard drinking family where you're lied to often, you know, starting with that phrase, "I'm not drunk," which is pretty much always a lie. I just had this, I don't know, some kind of burning need to figure out what had happened in my childhood, what it was all about and who we were all about. So,
to what extent did you have to make peace with your childhood and with your family before you could start writing these memoirs? That seems like a really important step that has to be taken.
That's what I think. It's certainly true that writing a memoir is always cathartic, and you always learn things about yourself and your beloveds, I think. You think you know the story, and as Jeffrey Wolfe once said, you know, the truth ambushes you. You always learn something that you wish you probably wish you didn't know about yourself. But for me, I was in therapy for 10 years before I could even undertake the story in a novel. And I tell my friends who are getting divorced, who want to write memoirs about getting divorced, don't write a memoir about getting divorced in the middle of the divorce. You know, wait, give yourself 7 or 8 years, I think. You know, there are people who write very young, like Dave Eggers, and do a tremendous job, obviously. But most of us need a little hair on us. I think we need a little seasoning. And for me, I think I needed a lot of therapy. I was certainly not angry in any way with my family when I wrote Liars Club, or with my ex-husband when I wrote Lit. The enemy in all my books has been myself, my own so-called mind.
And you write that, you know, when you go to therapy, you are paying the therapist. When you're writing a memoir, they are hopefully paying you.
Because yeah, and that means you owe them. Yeah, that's right. That means you owe them something.
Right.
So it's not really about, even though, I mean, what will have more consequence for you psychologically as a writer than writing about your own life? You know, few stories are going to mean more to you than your own. But and to some extent, even novelists write about their own lives and their own psyches. But obviously, when it's your material, your day-to-day life, the events you've lived through, it's a different story.
Mary, you've talked a lot, of course, about drinking and getting sober, and how has that affected your writing and how you approach writing?
Well, I didn't have much success before I got sober, to be quite honest with you. I had some modest success. You know, I published in some little magazines, but I got sober in 89, and that's, you know, it's when I began to pray and meditate. I wasn't Christian or anything then, but it was recommended to me by other women who were sober that I'd probably have a better chance of perceiving reality instead of just beaming it from my eyeballs if I had some kind of daily, you know, centering meditation practice. And I started doing that before I wrote, and I would ask to write what was true. What was the, you know, it's the old Hemingway saw, you know, write one true sentence. I would sort of ask for that, you know, not from God, but from some idea of a sober self or something. So without the spiritual practice, who knows? I certainly had way more success after I got sober than I ever did drunk, even though I fancied myself, you know, a great swashbuckling literary figure, you know, while I was listing on my bar stool.
And we put a great emphasis on truth and honesty and in sobriety, and I think you have 24 more years than I do. It sounds like I've got
good for you though, huh?
Thank you. I'm doing my best.
The first two are the hardest. It's going to get a lot better.
That's good to hear.
I know, right? I know. I remember thinking, you know, I think in my own mind I had this kind of mean school marm self, and when I was drinking, I thought, if I could just beat myself into submission, I was always going to stop drinking the next day. And then, of course, I thought getting sober meant that person was in charge of me.
Right.
The mean voice in my head would be in charge of me. So great surprise that wasn't true.
I'm curious, because I read a lot of your poetry as well, and I'm curious if you see a huge distinction between writing poetry or memoir, or if there's some kind of overlap between the two.
I think the tradition of confessional poetry or autobiographical poetry began at the same time. Memoir sort of started to in the middle of the last century. You know, Robert Lowell, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks, you know, those are all poets who write very much out of their own lives. And at the same time that Richard Wright and Nabokov and Mary McCarthy and those people were writing in memoir. So, but memoir is just emotionally way harder and technically way easier.
It's funny. It makes me think of Willie Nelson. Someone asked him one time what his secret was to songwriting, and he said that he thought songwriters were basically writing out of loneliness, that they're lonely people. And I wonder, do you think that's true also for writers?
It's true for me. I know a lot of writers who are. I mean, we're the people who take bad selfies. You know, where if you go to the National Book Award, I always joke that we're like America's homeliest video. You know, we all spill.
You
on
walk
our,
into a newsroom.
Really? Well, yeah. Same people. Writers. You know, it's we're not really known for our glamour, except in our own minds. So, I think I was certainly a really lonely child, and I'm an odd person. You know, I grew up in an odd way that most people, you know, hopefully had it a little easier, but a lot of people had it way worse. So I still wouldn't have traded my family or my, you know, for anything. I loved them.
So in the preface to the book, you mentioned some of the memoirs that you hold very closely, including Richard Wright's Black Boy, Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, Maxine Helm Kingston, Nabokov, and many others. What do you think these writers have in common that makes them great memoirists?
I think they developed a talent for their talent. I think they embraced and notion of truth, and they found a voice. I mean, to me, voice is the big bandwidth cable that permits a writer to download his or her experience into the reader's, you know, thoracic chest cavity and head and heart, I think. So I think they all have extremely distinctive voices. You wouldn't mistake one for another. And they're talented in different ways. You know, Nabokov is very cold. Angelou is very warm. Richard Wright is bitter and angry, and they all sound very different. You know, they have their emotional tenor or tones are different. They all write very vivid physical details, but they're also, I think, psychologically self-aware. I think they're aware of themselves. And the books are kind of ordered around a particular set of psychological developments, I think. So the books read like a whole story rather than just a bunch of random episodes.
It seems to me that a lot of people are accusing readers today and writers today of having some sort of self-infatuation, and that being why they get into memoir writing. And I'm curious, as you have students who are coming through your classes, if that's the impulse you see in them to write and want to study memoir,
it's really interesting to think Philip Roth doesn't have a self-infatuation. I mean, that Ernest Hemingway didn't. Any human who sits alone in a room writing books has a self-infatuation. We're all narcissistic. We pray that we're not narcissists, malignant narcissists, but we're all narcissistic. So there's nobody, I think, who's a writer who isn't self-infatuated. I think it's more socially acceptable now. I mean, if you think about it, before interpretation of dreams at the beginning of the last century, there wasn't even an idea of an unconscious. And Freud, I think, drove that idea that there was an unconscious self or a truer self that you sort of hid from yourself, and that could sort of make you do things you didn't want to do, and could push you in directions that weren't healthy for you to go. So to some extent, I think memoir is an offshoot of a century of thinking about the psyche, or the idea that the interior life, not what's going on outside, but the psychological life lived inside the scene is where, you know, our larger stories are lodged.
You write that unless you're a doubter and a worrier, a nail biter, an apologizer, a rethinker, then memoir may not be your playpen.
I'm just a big apologizer. I guess I broke the delete key off my keyboard writing lit, and I threw away 1,200, you know, type finished polished pages. They weren't just rough drafts. They were things I'd worked on over probably 4 or 5 years. So, you know, I felt those pages were untrue. Not that I had made things up, but there was just some posturing or absence of emotional depth or emotional truth to them that made them really boring, just tedious as all get out.
It's a great book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I murdered myself writing. I'm so glad to hear you say that.
Mary, I'm curious, can you compare your life today to where it was when you started all of this? What is your life and your writing life like today?
Well, I think most of my life I spent memorizing the bad news. I think I was a depressed child and a depressed adult, and I had a major depressive episode, you know, in 1988. And I think I have a lot of joy in my life. I live in New York City. My kid's grown and engaged and happy. I've had the same gentleman caller for 9 years, you know. I think the graduate program I teach in, I think of it as mine because I've been there longer than everybody else. But I at Syracuse, you know, my students are, we get so many more applications. We used to get a few hundred applications, and I think a few years ago we had 1,000 for 12 positions. So, you know, I teach with, wow, George Saunders and Arthur Flowers, all these great great writers, Dana Spiota, the novelist Dana Spiota. It's a lucky time to be me.
Mary Carr's new book is The Art of Memoir. You can find out more about it on her website, marycarr.com. She is also a voracious Twitterer, so follow her on Twitter at Mary Carr Litt, MaryKarrLit. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
You guys have a great day.
Well, I'm a mess. Nothing less.
Me, but can I be you for a while? My dog won't bite if you sit real still. I got the Antichrist.
A new play at Dallas's Upstart Productions tackles young female friendships and abortion. It's written by a young female playwright, directed by a young female director, and performed by young female actors. The name of the play is Dry Land, and director Sarah Hamilton joins us in the studio today to talk about it. Sarah, welcome to Mixed Media.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this play and what the story is and how you found it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the play has a pretty straightforward storyline. You got these two high school girls. You got the senior who has just transferred here, is an amazingly talented swimmer. She lives and breathes swimming, doesn't have much of a social life, and is kind of an outcast. And then you've got the younger girl, who is a junior in high school, pretty much the opposite in terms of the social scene of the school, very much more in line with the cool party crowd and gets into a lot more trouble. And so these two girls both end up on the swim team together at this school. We find out that the younger girl, Amy, is pregnant and is trying to figure out how to get rid of this pregnancy. So in this way, the Amy enlists Esther, the older girl, to help her on this quest. And they end up becoming friends, even though they come from different ends of the social food chain, if you will.
And Ruby Ray Spiegel, the playwright, she received a lot of accolades when it premiered in New York City last year for her ability to write teenage girls. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about how the dialogue plays out.
Yeah, that's one of the, I mean, this is an incredible play, but the dialogue is definitely one of its biggest strengths, in my opinion. Ruby Ray is able to capture these teenage voices. I think a lot of that has to do with that she is still so young herself.
And she's so how old now?
I think she might be about my age, maybe 23, 24.
And she was 21 when she wrote it.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure she graduated from school the same year I did.
Oh, wow.
So, so we're about the same age. But she's able, I think, because she's not that far removed from the high school scene, her dialogue has all these really recent cultural references in it. A lot of slang and colloquialisms that just hit the ear and you recognize in a way that is not so common with a lot of contemporary plays. So she is able to write these teenagers. There's a lot of likes, there's a lot of ums, there's a lot of silly banter and jokes going on. But there's also a lot of ugliness in that way that we see with teenagers. We hear them talking about things like, wait, how do you know about that? Like, how have you been exposed to that? Or, oh, that's your impression of what sex is? Wow, that disturbs me. So I think it's that combination of being really up to date and also not afraid to show the darker side of being a teenager that makes her dialogue really successful.
And you explained it to me yesterday as lacking that inexplicable wisdom that teenagers have in a lot of contemporary plays.
I think when you have plays like this where you have people who are too young to be dealing with these adult issues, a lot of times you find that the characters somehow achieve this higher level of wisdom and grace, maturity beyond their years. And I don't know if that really happens in this play.
Or in real life.
at the end of the play, they're still 17 and 18 years old, and they still are in high school, and they're still dealing with exactly the same issues and have pretty much the same priorities they've had throughout the play. So that's another reason I think this play is really effective in showing teenagers for who they really are.
So abortion is such a loaded topic. It's like, how was that handled in the play, and what is the tone of the play?
Yeah, I really like the way the play handles it because it isn't really about, in my opinion, the plot is not about whether or not she's going to have this abortion. It's always kind of decided from the beginning, this is the choice that she's made. The conflict of the play comes from the relationship of these two characters. So the play doesn't really make a stand on pro-choice, pro-life, whether or not this is what should be done about this political issue in our country. But because it does show, it takes this one storyline of this girl who is in this position and chooses to make this decision and goes so fearlessly in depth with her and her story, it makes you start asking these questions about, okay, well, why doesn't she have access to abortion? Why does she choose the path that she does? How did she get pregnant in the first place? Why is it that she has to order a pill off the internet? Why can't she go to her doctor? Why can't she tell her mother? So because it gets you asking these questions, it really gets you thinking about abortion in our country and all the women that are faced with a similar situation.
Questions that seem particularly relevant in a place like, say, Texas?
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
What can you tell us about Upstart Productions? I'm looking at the location here, and it sounds like it matches the name of the company.
Oh, yeah. So Upstart, this is my first production with Upstart. I met David. He approached me and shared this play with me, and we both really loved it and decided to work on it together.
And David
David Denson is the artistic director.
Right.
Of Upstart. And so then he told me where we were going to do it, and I was so intrigued, and we were on exactly the same page about it. So we're doing it in this warehouse that was previously an auto repair shop down in Oak Cliff. And the first time I went in there, it was a hot mess. It was full of all kinds of abandoned car parts, and it was a total
riddled with asbestas and
yeah. In our first rehearsal there, actually, we did see a rat, and the girls were upset, but it was okay. He ran away. We haven't seen him since. But yeah, so it's been a very much do it yourself, build it from the ground up experience, which is just my style, and I think actually really suited for Texas itself. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You want to do something, work hard and make it happen. And the space itself is really well suited for the play and is turning out to be really, really beautiful and fitting. So it's been fabulous.
Cool. Was it a pizza rat?
The rat did not have pizza.
How disappointing.
Yeah. Just plain old rat.
Well, to move on from the rat for a minute, Chris Wagner. I'm curious, this is an all-female production, is that right? Are there any males in terms of actors or the crew?
Yeah, there's two male characters we have. They're both only in one scene each. We do meet Victor, who is a student at Florida State. We meet him when Esther goes to visit Florida State to try out for their swim team. And then the only other male character in the play is the school janitor.
Yeah. My understanding is that this sort of largely female-driven production was possibly a response to some criticism or some commentary that happened.
Sarah might not know this. I got a phone call from David Denson last week that said, "You're going to love this play, Lauren. You've given us a lot of crap about being hyper male-centric. Trust me, you'll want to look into this play." And I thought, well, David, I'm happy to hear that criticism isn't dead.
Norrit Smart, the fighting feminist of the Dallas Observer.
But I am curious, Sarah, from your perspective as a young female director in Dallas, what are the opportunities in sort of female playwright land, female director?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of opportunities do you see, or what's lacking in the city?
Yeah, I mean, I have a different experience than probably a lot of young directors my age, because I've been able to self-produce a lot of work. So in that way, I have been very lucky, just because I can decide that I want to do something and do it. However, I just in terms of when I go see productions, when I'm going around town, when I'm trying to absorb all the things that are out there for me, I do notice this lack of, I mean, I'm trying to remember the last time I went and saw a play in the established theater scene in Dallas that was directed by a woman.
But that doesn't run the company.
Yeah.
Isn't Tina Parker.
Tina Parker or Catherine Owens.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, I don't know if I can remember the last time that happened. So, I mean, I think definitely things are getting better. For me, I've been able to make a lot of my own opportunities and have been very grateful to meet some wonderful people and collaborators along the way. But I think there's definitely still work to be done, especially for directors, women directors, I think.
Well, because you're part of House Party Theater, and which is closely associated with movements like Shakespeare in the Bar and Prism Co. and all these young professionals creating their own work and creating their own opportunities. I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about House Party Theater.
Yeah, absolutely. House Party Theater is a company that Chris McCrary, my partner in crime, it was his brainchild, and he moved back to Dallas from LA almost a year ago now. And Chris and Ted Guara and I are kind of the triumvirate at the head of it, and we have a company of great actors, writers, and talented theater artists who work with us. And basically what we started doing was we realized that the work that we were seeing around town wasn't really satisfying us because the quality was not as high as we wanted it to be. We didn't feel like it was challenging us, and we didn't feel like it was for the audience. It seemed to be about something else. And so we were like, okay, we all have theater degrees. What's stopping us from doing something a little different? So we started doing plays. The first one we did in Dallas was in our friend's living room. And then we did one.
The best kind, right there.
Yep. And then we did one in another friend's backyard. And then since then, we've moved a little bit out of the houses, but I'm sure that we will end up doing plays there again. But we basically just started doing theater that was good for an audience, to be a gift to an audience as opposed to some kind of hoity-toity grant-winning
A Night at the Theater, yeah. if you will.
Yeah. So we started doing that, and it's been a whole lot of fun, and I've been so pleased and surprised with the success that we've had with it, just one, being able to make it happen, and two, to find out that, okay, we were right about this. People do want to see this. Yeah. Okay, people do want to come see this kind of thing. So that's been great.
You think we're good?
Yep.
All right. So I will do the outro.
Yes, but that's good. That was a good ender moment. I'm excited. Yeah. That was a good optimistic note to wrap on.
Okay. We'll start talking right now. Upstart Productions' Dry Land by Ruby Ray Spiegel opens this weekend and runs through October 10th. Performances will be at 2336 North Beckley Avenue. That is indeed a former auto restoration shop near Trinity Groves on the west side of the Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge, or Large Marge, as I like to call her. Tickets are available at upstarttheater.com. That is theater with an E-R at the end. Sarah Hamilton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So you found a girl who thinks really deep thoughts. What's so amazing about really deep thoughts? Boy, you best pray that I bleed real soon.
Found control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Matt Damon is in a new movie. It is called The Martian. It opens a week from Friday. Directed by Ridley Scott. It is, in fact, about an astronaut, much like our Major Tom of David Bowie's Space Oddity, who gets stranded on Mars when the rest of his party believes he has died there. And he has to figure out a way to survive, which is a little easier than you might expect because he's an awesome botanist. I got to interview...
Of course he is.
I got to interview Matt Damon a couple of weeks ago on the phone. We'll hear a little bit of that. I've long been fascinated with Mr. Damon, and I'll tell you a little bit.
Yeah, I'm wondering why.
Yeah, I just want to know why.
Okay.
Just get right to
it. And you'll hear Mr. Damon himself talk about this in a minute.
His own fascination with himself?
Exactly. I think he's one of these movie stars who just does his work and doesn't end up in the tabloids. We never really hear much about his personal life. There was this brief little kind of dust up over something he said on Project Greenlight recently, which I thought was kind of a mountain made of a molehill. He's one of these kind of old-time movie stars, except he doesn't have the gossips trailing him all the time. He has somehow managed to diffuse that.
TMZ has lost interest in him.
And I find that fascinating and rather admirable, actually.
Admirable or sad for him, but he's become so uninteresting.
I think it's admirable. I think his wife probably finds him interesting. I think his kids probably him interesting. People continue to pay money to see his movies. He continues to work with, you know, Martin Scorsese and Ridley Scott and the Coen brothers and Paul Greengrass and pretty much, you know, a lot of the great filmmakers out there right now.
I want to know what you think the definitive Matt Damon film is.
It's still got to be Good Will Hunting, being that was kind of the launching pad, and that's, you know, him and Ben won the screenwriting Oscar for that. Nobody had really heard of him before that, I don't think. And yeah, I mean, he's still kind of the iconic scene of him as the "how you like them apples" moment in that movie. So I think that's probably as iconic as we're gonna get with him. And that's another thing I like about him. He doesn't really have, like, he's kind of a character actor in a movie star's career.
What is a Matt Damon stinker? What's a good stinker that he made?
Good question.
A bad Matt Damon movie? That's kind of tough, actually. I'm sure they exist.
The Zoo?
He has
The Zoo?
People love that movie,
That's not that bad. And hence another reason I like Matt Damon. He has really good taste. He picks good movies. Of course, there's this impression of him still as kind of a pretty boy movie star. And this is what, of course, was played with in Team America, and I think a lot of people hear Matt Damon and they think, Matt Damon. So here's a little supercut from the greatness of Team America.
Matt Damon. Matt Damon. Matt Damon. Matt Damon. Matt Damon.
You can find anything on YouTube now.
Damon.
It's kind of amazing. So they're messing with him both for his movie starness, and, you know, he's a fairly outspoken liberal. you know, in his own quiet sort of way. And that's that movie, you know, it's, I think it's a really funny movie, actually. It goes very scorched earth on political people in Hollywood. And I have my own mixed feelings about that. So that's kind of, I think, a lot of people's impression of Matt Damon still is Matt Damon.
Actually, I want to ask our guest, Sarah, what do you think of Matt Damon?
I honestly, I'm into Matt Damon. I think.
All right, get out.
Thank you. I knew
we're on the same page.
I knew I liked you the moment you walked in this room.
Ryan, just cut out segment two today. And we're just gonna start.
Sarah's out.
So why are you into Matt Damon?
Well, I think, I mean, it has to do with what you're saying. I always enjoy watching Matt Damon. I mean, it's as simple as that. Even in, he plays a pretty wide variety of different types of characters. And I think he always does things that are really appropriate for the roles. And I always really enjoy watching him. And for me in movies, that's the most important thing.
He's a very likable presence.
Well, okay, I think we need to back up. I feel like we're all, like, you guys are jumping on the defend Matt Damon.
Yeah. I already voted. I voted for, I wrote him in for president and for 2016.
I think that this is related to a few weeks ago. I don't know if I said it on air or off air. I mentioned how little I like Matt Damon.
Oh, no, it's not just you.
Okay, well.
There are others out there.
I just feel like Matt Damon doesn't need defense. He is a celebrity, whether he's in the spotlight or not.
All right, so let's go the other. Let's reverse it. Why don't you like Matt Damon? What's your problem with Matt Damon?
I just think he's boring. I just don't. You know, like Mary Carr was talking about needing a voice to have. So I feel like Matt Damon could. He's like a piece of cardboard that you could put anything on, and you know that what's interesting is what is on the cardboard, not the piece of cardboard.
But can't you say that about almost any character actor?
No, I don't think that's necessarily true. So for me, this whole any fascination with him, I think, is misplaced because I think he's just bland.
Well, Sarah,
and I know a lot of America disagrees.
Sarah Hamilton disagrees with you. And she is a director of theater.
I think Lauren's onto it, though, because in a way, it's like trying to have it both ways. He's both this kind of great character actor, but then he's also this sort of movie star figure.
He's not trying to have it both ways. He has it both ways.
Well, he does have it both. Sure, I guess to your point, you're right. And it's like he weirdly doesn't walk either side completely. And so he's not satisfying in either category.
And so, and so haters gonna hate.
Right, sure. I find there are so many other actors who are far more interesting, far more attractive, far more. I also was saying to Christopher earlier, I have very often, and I know I'm not the only person who has done this, I get him confused with Mark Wahlberg. And I'm not entirely sure.
But, I think that's on you, actually.
No,
they were both in The Departed.
No, they're
physically similar, kind of the squared off heads, the big beefy vanilla exteriors.
Marky Mark's way more kind of, you know, hip hop, hey man, what's going on? And Matt Damon is more, I think, just straight ahead dude. I think Mark Wahlberg to me is still, part of my mind, Mark Wahlberg is still an underwear model.
Right.
And whereas Matt Damon was kind of came on as a writer. And as an actor. But I should say I'm also a Mark Wahlberg fan.
Well, and I think for me, the only way I can figure out how to distinguish the two of them is I look for which one has sort of the most show muscles.
I was like,
Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
What do you look for?
they are both very much from Boston as well.
That's
although
true.
You don't hear it as much in Damon's voice. So as I said, I did get to talk to Matt Damon. The profile is going to run on Sunday. One of the things we talked about and one of the things that I admire is that ability to stay out of the spotlight, and he attributes some of that to the choices he has made as far as who he got married to. He married a woman who is not in the business and just the kind of profile he keeps. So here is Matt Damon talking a little bit about that.
And then I think I got lucky in marrying a woman who isn't in the business, you know, and so there's less of a kind of appetite for everything relating to our life. You know what I mean? Like the kind of the tabloids just leave us alone, you know. And I think ultimately what sells those things anyway is kind of scandal and sex and all this stuff. And it, as long as the narrative in, you know, my story is he's a married guy with four kids and he lives pretty quietly, there's no real sizzle there for them, so they don't really bother. Which is great because we live a relatively normal life.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So
he sounds so normal.
Maybe that lack of sizzle is what Lauren Smart doesn't like.
Till we find out he has a secret life.
She wants more sizzle.
Yeah. I want the like
being a decent actor and a good human being just
there
not,
are a lot
not
of decent
cut it.
Actors.
I'm not saying
there
aren't. I'm not saying
there
aren't.
The last film I enjoyed of him was Talented Mr. Ripley.
That was like okay. Did you didn't like any of the Bourne movies?
I didn't.
It's
really?
Just kind of not my thing.
You don't like any of the Bourne movies?
No.
Well, you're like the only person on the planet, probably.
I know.
I mean, they're well done and satisfying and great thrillers.
The Adjustment Bureau.
That's okay.
You didn't like the Adjustment Bureau?
No, I hated that. Actually.
Wow, you're the only person I've ever talked to who hates the Adjustment Bureau.
I don't know. It just didn't do anything for me. But
The Good Shepherd, I think, is a really underrated movie about the history of the CIA. It's directed by Robert De Niro.
I don't think I saw that.
He did what's the movie where he plays the oil speculator?
Oh yeah.
From a few years ago. No Man's Land, I believe it's called. Sorry if I got that wrong, Matt. I generally like the kinds of projects he selects. He was really good in True Grit, I thought. The Coen Brothers movie. I don't think he wasn't Jeff Bridges, but he played that role really well. And it seems like really good directors really like working with him.
So sort of in summation, very talented, does interesting roles. We just can't get excited about him.
Yeah. And to me, that's kind of exciting.
And you know.
I mean, there's nothing salacious about the guy.
Yeah.
Oh, but you know, you have to, if we've spent this much time talking about him, there's something about him not being interesting that's actually kind of interesting
to us. That's intriguing. Yeah. That's the most intriguing thing.
Which is kind of my point. I mean, the reason why you might not think he's that interesting is you don't know much about him.
Sure.
Neither do I.
True.
Nobody in this room does. And I think that's really cool. Mm-hmm. I think he's managed to actually live a life as a regular human being in a world that provokes anything but that kind of response.
I was going to say, it's certainly rare. You know, James Franco's, you know, Instagramming daily shirtless pics, and everybody's all about promoting everything and putting everything out there. And you're right, he does lead a very quiet,
he does not give
calm
an
life.
F
yeah.
about any of it.
Good for you, Matt. I think clearly you're the one winning on this.
So Matt Damon's awesome.
Yeah. Enjoy your life.
That's the summation of our conversation. So is my profile of Matt Damon, although I haven't written it yet, but it also will be very awesome.
I think we just wrote it right here, right now.
There it is.
I'm just going to go tell my editor doesn't need to happen now. No,
Matt Damon, not interesting, but worth it anyway.
It will be in Sunday's Dallas Morning News. If you have any hot Matt Damon opinions, please drop us a note at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping. What if I were Romeo in black jeans?
Let's move on to our touts. This is the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, eating, drinking. Did I say eating? No, I did
not. Snorting.
Snorting. No, I don't.
No,
I don't.
No snorting.
We don't talk about that.
Those were youthful indiscretions, Christopher. Or just plain obsessed with. And we are going to start with our guest, Miss Hamilton.
Thanks. Well, I am touting Small Brew Pub today. I have started frequenting this...
In Oak Cliff, yeah.
In Oak Cliff, yeah. I've started frequenting this lovely establishment. Everything there is incredible, from the menu, which you don't usually expect from a place that brews beer. You don't usually expect them to have a great menu, but this is so top-notch. They have amazing beer.
Does it have a name?
What?
It's called...
Yeah.
What is it called?
It's called
Small Brew Pub.
Oh, no way. Yeah. That's awesome.
It's not A. Well, it is a small
I thought you were just saying,
small,
I want to tout a small brew pub.
It's very meta.
The Small Brew Pub.
My
to
bad.
Be precise.
Please continue.
But yeah, and then my favorite thing, though, has got to be the cocktails. If I can go to a place where I can have a good beer or a good cocktail, I'm set. I would definitely spend all my money there if I lived in the neighborhood. So it's good that I live a little bit farther away.
That can be a tough combo, because a lot of places have the really good beer or the really good cocktail.
Exactly.
It's hard to find one that has both.
And nowhere else, I don't think, in Dallas has chicken feet on the menu.
Right? Yeah. They have all these weird things on the menu that I would never get otherwise.
Deep fried chicken feet.
But however, I know if I order it there, I will probably enjoy it. Makes me a more adventurous eater.
Christopher Wynn has a really weird tout. Why don't you lay it on us?
God, this has been controversial. We haven't even gotten to it yet.
I don't know about controversial. I just think it's kind of weird, actually.
It is kind of weird. So I have this thing for creepy children's choir covers.
Yes, you do.
Not the choir themselves, but sort of eerie children's choir covers of pop songs. So this started with something called the Langley Schools Music Project. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this or not, but it was a group of recordings of a group of Canadian school children singing popular songs at the time. You know, the Beach Boys, Paul McCartney, David Bowie, etc. This was in the late 70s. They were cobbled together into a recording that was released in 2001, and it's been kind of a cult hit since then. And actually, the Jack Black film School of Rock is sort of loosely based on the instructor behind this program. And it's I have a thing for cover songs anyway. When we hear the same song all the time, the same version we're used to, it just becomes white noise. And when you hear a different version, you experience it in a whole nother way. And so I thought it was very powerful. And actually, Brian, this is a different song. This is the next creepy choir song coming up. But Langley School's Music Project, I want to play a clip for one. This is them doing the Beach Boys. So you can hear, it just has this really haunting and kind of lyrical quality to it.
It's
and
not
just,
creepy, though.
Unless it was the beginning of a horror movie.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes those things creepy, though.
You're Home Alone. So it's beautiful. They did that. They do, you know, Fleetwood Mac's Rihanna, and they have a whole group of Space Oddity that we just heard. David Bowie, they do a cover version of that.
It reminds me a little bit of the version of Creep, the Radiohead song that was in Social Network.
That's my next one. So that was a perfect transition. So a more modern version of that same idea is with, for example, Creep. That is actually a Belgian women's choir, Scalia and the Kolechny brothers.
Easy for you to say.
Try that again. Who arranged and accompanied the piece. But they are doing this also, and they did a version of Creep by Radiohead that was used to great effect in the Social Network.
The trailer. Yeah, it was awesome.
So let's take a minute to listen to that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that
I like
version
that.
Of that song.
I like that.
It's beautiful. So, you know,
it's no Matt Damon. Yeah. But it's pretty awesome.
So, way more interesting.
So it's kind of a thing. I love it. It's sort of, you know, it's just pretty haunting. Grab some wine, kick back.
Do it.
Yeah.
I will move on to my tout now, and then Lauren Smart will close us out. My tout is a book. I have this backlog of books that I need to write about, so I just kind of unspooling them as touts week after week. this is the second time I have touted a book about Detroit recently. This is a nonfiction book. It's called Once in a Great City by the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and editor David Marinus. Mm-hmm. I hope I am pronouncing your name correctly, David. It's basically about Detroit on the cusp of this strange area where it's rising and about to sink. Early 60s, mid 60s, the height of Motown. Ford is still going very strong. Martin Luther King actually did the first run of his I Have a Dream speech in Detroit around the same period. And it's basically looking at the glory, kind of the final glory of a city that we now look at as this symbol of urban blight. And it's kind of a sad story because you really do, you know, feel how powerful and glorious this place was at a certain time in history. And, you know, look at it now. Maybe we overstate sometimes just how bad it's doing, but they did declare bankruptcy. They're not doing all that well. So,
well, as I said on a previous episode, Detroit is coming back among the style crowd and people are moving in.
Yep.
Buying up property, beautiful, gorgeous properties at, you know, very low prices, and artists are, you know, moving in and doing things. So that's kind of the natural cycle of things.
And it makes me want to watch Detroitopia, I believe it's called, something like that. It's a documentary that came out.
I was like, is this a spinoff of Portlandia?
No, it's not. It's a documentary about these conceptual artists who do strange things in Detroit. That sounds like it ties in a little bit.
Yeah, it would be a nice tie-in.
With what you're talking about. The other Detroit book I mentioned recently is a novel called You Don't Have to Live Like This by an Austin native named Benjamin Markovitz. Lauren Smart, take us out.
So mine is just a song that I came across on Spotify this week.
Is it creepy?
It is not. It's very,
is there a children's
it's
choir
very
involved?
Fun and breezy.
Well, I don't want to hear it then.
It's by a band called Springtime Carnivore, and the song is called Name on a Matchbook. So that is my tout this week. Play it in the car with the windows down.
Nice.
You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmedia. Please subscribe to our show on iTunes and leave us a review. Just search for our name, Mixed Media. Today's Mixed Media was engineered very nobly and patiently by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, and Sarah Hamilton, I'm Chris Wagner. We thank you for joining us. Thank you.